October 3rd program of the City Club of Eugene, addressing sexual assault from institutional betrayal to institutional courage. Thank you for joining us. Greetings to our broadcast television and radio audience. I'm Marlene Nesri, City Club President. Our City Club sponsors for today are Evans, Elder & Brown, Gatos, Churnside & Balthrop, and Dot Dotson's Photography. Special thanks go to KPFF Consulting Engineers for supplying our office space and to KLCC Radio for airing these programs at 6:30 on Monday nights and for archiving all of our broadcasts. We're pleased to welcome new members, Jack and Kay Marietta. A quick reminder that we host nearly 50 original nonpartisan issue programs every year. If you believe with us that civic engagement is the lifeblood of democracy, please consider becoming a City Club donor, sponsor, regular or virtual member. Today's program, Addressing Sexual Assault from Institutional Betrayal to Institutional Courage, features two researchers from the University of Oregon, Dr. Jennifer Freed and doctoral candidate Carly Smith. They'll explain how they measure institutional betrayal and what they have learned from their research, which has focused on institutional responses to military and campus sexual assault. They have uncovered some of the specific mechanisms by which universities currently fail to prevent sexual assault and cause additional harm to victims. Their research reveals areas of institutional policy and practice that they believe should be changed to promote movement from institutional betrayal to institutional courage. Dr. Freed is a professor of psychology at the University of Oregon. She directs a laboratory investigating the impact of interpersonal and institutional trauma on mental and physical health, behavior, and society. Her work is widely published and widely translated. This past spring, Dr. Freed was twice invited to the U.S. White House to share her research on sexual assault and institutional betrayal. Carly Smith is a doctoral candidate in clinical psychology at the University of Oregon. She is a member of the University Coalition to End Sexual Violence and was nominated by the University Senate to serve on the task force to end sexual violence and support survivors. Please join me in welcoming our speakers, Dr. Jennifer Freed and Carly Smith, to the podium.
Thank you so much for inviting me and for being here today. I'm very honored to get a chance to talk to this group of people and to the radio listeners later on. I've been at the University of Oregon as a faculty member since 1987, and I've been researching trauma and sexual violence since 1991, so for more than 20 years. And I want to tell you a little bit about those two decades of research, and then explain a little bit how it leads us to where we are today, and then I'm going to turn the floor over to Carly Smith. I want to talk to you about three related concepts. They are betrayal trauma, betrayal blindness, and institutional betrayal. And I'm going to be drawing quite heavily upon a paper that was authored by Carly Smith as first author and myself and published a few months ago in American Psychologist, as well as a book that I wrote with my colleague Pamela Burrell called Blind to Betrayal that was published in 2013. I'm going to start by reading from the new paper that Carly Smith and I wrote. Lizzie Seberg was a 19-year-old freshman at St. Mary's College when she reported being sexually assaulted by a male acquaintance in a campus dormitory. However, the dormitory in question was not Lizzie's. It belonged to her male acquaintance, a football player at a neighboring school, the University of Notre Dame. After Lizzie reported the assault to the Notre Dame campus police, she began receiving text messages from other members of the football team. "Don't do anything you would regret," read one. "Messing with Notre Dame football is a bad idea," another. As the campus police investigated the charges over the next several days, they interviewed several witnesses and Lizzie herself repeatedly, but they did not interview the accused student until 2 weeks following Lizzie's report. In the meantime, Lizzie was subjected to intense personal doubt about whether reporting the assault meant that she had severed ties to Notre Dame, a university that she had grown up revering among family members who were alumni, dedicated football fans, or both. 10 days after reporting the assault, Lizzie committed suicide. When Lizzie's parents sought answers from the school, the president of the university declined to speak with them. The school declined to comment publicly. 6 months after Lizzie's death, a disciplinary hearing was held in which the accused student was found not responsible for sexual misconduct. He did not miss a football practice or game, including the national championship game. Lizzie's parents were denied access to the records of Lizzie's complaint and the disciplinary hearing. Ultimately, there's a sense of betrayal, said Tom Seberg, Lizzie's father. There's a sense of the university not living its values. It's not our intention to take down this great institution, but it has disappointed us. That hurts, and it hurts our family. Lizzie's story is at once common and at once extraordinary. Her experience of sexual assault and the doubts about reporting it is shared by many, many college students, and in that way, it's common. Her experience of unhelpful law enforcement and unresponsive legal systems, a kind of a second assault, as it's been called, is faced by many rape survivors who are further blamed or stigmatized when they request help from institutions. Lizzie's particular story is embedded in a prestigious university home to a storied athletic program with a high-profile student athlete as the alleged perpetrator. Her experience was overlooked by fans with generations-deep allegiance to Notre Dame athletics. School administrators sought to protect the institutional reputation, even as the story found multiple footholds in the press. These details, when viewed in aggregate, provide a stark picture of the institutional actions and inactions that contributed to Lizzie's traumatic experience. The harmful actions and inactions by the institution are what we call institutional betrayal. The fans and others who refused at first to see the institutional betrayal, we call betrayal blindness. The extraordinary part of Lizzie's story is that the Seabergs looked at this picture and saw the betrayal, and other people began to as well. This awareness, it represents an incredible understanding, shedding the protective unawareness of betrayal. And I think it's an incredible moment in our history and our time that we're beginning to see something that's been in front of it, been there all along. So I'm going to tell you a little bit more about this concept of betrayal blindness and what we know about it. And we've been studying this for more than 20 years, but in a slightly different context. We've asked the question, why would people turn a blind eye to betrayal? Because we have certainly seen that over and over again in history, as well as in our laboratory research. And the answer we proposed in the early 1990s, and have been refining since then, we call betrayal trauma theory. Betrayal trauma theory has two core elements to it that are then combined. One element is an observation about human beings and the way we operate in the world. And this is our exquisite sensitivity to betrayal in many situations. In fact, we're really good at detecting betrayal. We're really tuned to catch cheating when it's in front of us. The reason we're like that is that we are very social, we engage in contracts with one another all the time, and detecting betrayal is often an extremely important aspect of our survival. If somebody's cheating us, we need to notice it and do something about it. The two common responses to detecting cheating or betrayal are to withdraw from the situation or to confront the situation, metaphorically like flight or fight. That's what we do when we're empowered, and it's a good thing we do that, because otherwise we're going to get cheated over and over again, and that's not helpful. Hold that in mind for a minute and think about something else about human beings, which is that we have a huge amount of dependency in our experience. We are born premature in an animal kingdom sense. We are intensely dependent on our caregivers, and our dependency in childhood lasts for a very long time. Throughout the lifespan, we have times of dependency. It's very rare to be completely not dependent. We're often greatly dependent on others. We're not the only animals who have dependency. Most mammals do at times. The other primates do. Evolution has endowed us with a very powerful protective force called the attachment system. And in our dependency situation, we inspire the caregiving of those we're dependent on through the attachment system. Imagine a baby and what a baby does with a caregiver. The baby coos and smiles and engages from as early on as possible in a relationship with the caregiver. As humans, we experience the attachment system through the emotion of love. We love and get loved in return, and the behavior we engage in is one of approach and connection. And without that, we're in trouble. A baby who cannot do that is in trouble, even with very motivated parents. This is a powerful piece of our biology. Okay, we have this sensitivity to betrayal, we have this attachment system. What happens when the person we are dependent on betrays us? What happens? If we respond with awareness, we withdraw and confront. That is not an acceptable response in a highly dependent situation, because that will only make the situation more difficult for the betrayed or abused or mistreated person. So the core idea of betrayal trauma theory is that in that bind, attachment trumps the sensitivity to betrayal. We need to be blind to the betrayal to stay attached to a caregiver. It keeps us alive. It is a survival mechanism. This theory was one that my students and I started to work on 20 years ago, and we began to research it, and we've now published many articles. And all of our initial articles and research was focused on one-on-one betrayals. We looked at what happens when there was a betrayal in a close relationship, compared it to betrayals in not close relationships, and so on. And what we found over 20 years was two fundamental things. One, that there is betrayal blindness. We documented it. People are less aware of, they have more difficulty remembering. Events that involve abuse and mistreatment and betrayal if they're close to the perpetrator. The other, and this we didn't expect, is betrayal is really toxic. It has costs across the spectrum. It is bad for the body, it is bad for the mind, it is bad for the emotions. And we've been overwhelmed by how toxic betrayal is. I mean, literature, pick up a book, you can find it in literature and art, but we were overwhelmed when we saw it in the laboratory because we hadn't known it was going to be so strong. All along, I was interested in how could betrayal operate on larger systems, say the Holocaust, a genocide. But I didn't have any empirical handle on it. And along came Carly Smith. She arrived at the University of Oregon, and she came in the summer, right before her first year, and we started to take long walks along the Amazon pathway. I put my students through this. They're in good shape. We walk and we talk. Carly and I started to walk and talk. And she said, you know, I want to study institutional betrayal, and I want to get an empirical handle on it, and I want to measure it. And I said, wow, great. And she said, let's look at military sexual trauma, because clearly, by then we were hearing stories about it, clearly if somebody's abused in the military and they take it to their commanding officer and their commanding officer punishes them, that's institutional betrayal. So I said, yes, let's do that. And then we tried to get a military sample. Well, we quickly discovered we were not going to get a military sample within the time frame of a first-year project, which Carly also had to do. So Carly said, well, let's try looking at college students. I mean, you know, maybe it happens in college. And I'm like, oh, Carly, you know, college is nice. Universities are nice. Yeah, students do get assaulted. I know that. I've been seeing sexual assault in my laboratory. But we're not going to see institutional betrayal. Not very often. Once in a while, maybe. But you have a first-year project, and there's no requirement at work, and, you know, it'll help us create a measure. So Carly set out. She figured out some things to do that she's going to tell you about. And the next thing I knew, we had some very interesting data. This was now 4 years ago. And we were still operating in the obscurity that everybody who was ever studying sexual violence was operating in most of the time. Just not right now. And so we did the things that researchers do when you're operating in obscurity and you have some colleagues. We spent our time getting that work published. Things have become very different recently because there is a lot of attention to this topic. So Carly and I have been on this for about 5 years, and we've recently published this paper that I read to you about. And in this paper, we have made the proposal that, in fact, we do see blindness, betrayal blindness, in the institutional case, and that institutional betrayal is as toxic, probably, as interpersonal betrayal. And Carly will tell you more about that research.
Hello, everybody. Can you hear me okay? Excellent. Well, thank you so much for having me here today as well. This isn't a typical thing that a graduate student gets to do. And looking around the room and seeing some high-profile people, I'm a bit nervous, but I also watched you guys eat chocolate chip cookies, so I'm less nervous now. I want to start out a little bit and preface what I'm going to be talking about with something that I tell my students when I teach undergraduate trauma courses, that I'm about to run through some stuff that's probably pretty upsetting. I'm going to be talking about our own University of Oregon students and their experiences. And this stuff can be hard to bear. As Jennifer just pointed out, there's a certain point at which knowing about trauma becomes kind of unbearable. And I want to give you guys kind of fair warning that that's what the next 12 minutes or so might entail for you. And to cut yourself some slack. This is a hard topic to hear about. But I also want to ask you to notice the points at which it becomes almost too much to bear. Notice the points where you want to turn away and just reflect on why that might be. I'm not asking you to hear my scientific findings with no scrutiny whatsoever, but I just want to kind of put that out there. So I'm going to be talking about three studies today. Over the course of my time here, I just had to count for an application process, almost 15 different studies. I will not make you guys hear about all of them. So as Jennifer left off on, one of the first studies we really conducted here was actually in 2010, and we set out with this very basic question. If we ask college students about institutional betrayal, will they tell us it's something they've experienced? How many? What will it look like? And what happens when they experience it? We already knew that betrayal in an interpersonal relationship can be quite toxic, as Jennifer pointed out. And what this means is for two traumatic experiences that are identical in all but who is the perpetrator, the one that's perpetrated by someone close to the victim, someone they trust, results in much more harmful outcomes, more PTSD, more anxiety, more difficulty in interpersonal relationships, in a way that really points to the betrayal as the issue. And so when we created our institutional betrayal questionnaire, we needed to ask about ways in which an institution can betray. I mean, obviously they're not typically the ones perpetrating the initial trauma, and in this case, thinking about sexual assault, but we asked about things that occur around sexual violence. So an institution creating an environment in which that type of experience seemed common, like it was no big deal, or even creating an environment where it seemed almost more likely to occur, facilitated this type of experience. We asked about prevention efforts. Did an institution fail to prevent this? Was there something that you could see that they reasonably could have done, but they just didn't do it? We asked about the ease of reporting. And we asked about response to reports. If they did, in fact, report an experience to an institution, did they cover it up? Did they respond inadequately in some way? And so as you hear the phrasing of these questions, that's how specific they were. We left it up to the students to tell us if this happened, and what type of institution it was. In that initial study, because we were still not 100% sure they would know what we were talking about, we asked them to tell us a little bit about the experience. We also asked really careful questions, and we continue to do this, about what sexual trauma looked like. And this is going to become more important as I talk about some of the other studies. But when we measure sexual trauma, we measure it in a really specific way. And we ask very clear behavioral questions. Did someone touch you in a way that did not have your consent? And did someone either perform or make you perform oral sex without your consent? Did someone insert a finger, an object, a penis into your vagina or your anus? I'm guessing you guys weren't expecting to hear those words today. Heads up. And we ask it in these very clear behavioral ways for a reason I'll come back to later. Then we asked in this first study as well, how they were doing. We gave them a range of measures that assess psychological functioning in a way that's typical following a trauma. Anxiety, depression, dissociation, this kind of difficulty knowing and remembering and staying connected to your everyday experiences. And we looked to see what happened. And in that first study, we measured the experiences of 346 University of Oregon women. We collected their data through the human subject pool, which is a common way to collect information at the University of Oregon. Students sign up for studies, not really knowing what they're about, and then once they get told, they have the option to stay or go. They usually stay. And what we found was this. Of our students, of University of Oregon students, across their lifetime, 68% of the women reported at least one non-consensual event. So trauma is not uncommon in our students. They come to college. Most of these women were freshmen and sophomore. They come to college with a history of trauma, and then very often more is waiting for them once they enroll. When we asked them about that institutional betrayal, we weren't really sure what they would say. Well, 46% of the women who had an unwanted sexual experience also reported at least one form of institutional betrayal. And remember, this is lifetime. And so we weren't sure what institutions they would identify. We didn't have a whole lot of veterans. We thought maybe churches, schools. The most common source of institutional betrayal was a university or university-related system, a dormitory, a fraternity, a sorority. And when we asked them, when we looked at the most common form this institutional betrayal took, it was these environmental questions. An environment was created where this type of experience seemed common, like no big deal, or even more likely to occur. And when we looked at the outcomes, these psychological outcomes, we found that, unsurprisingly, experiencing any type of unwanted sexual, non-consensual experience was associated with more distress compared to women who had not had these experiences. Yet when we compared two women who had experienced the same type, same amount of non-consensual sexual experiences, the women who had also experienced institutional betrayal were doing much worse. More anxiety, more dissociation, more trauma-related symptoms. And so it appeared at this first study that institutional betrayal has the same type of toxicity that we saw in interpersonal betrayal. This wasn't just students saying like, ah, yeah, the man, not doing so great. It was having real experience, real psychological effects on their well-being. The other thing that we took away from this study was we took their responses seriously, that this environment seemed to be created in which these types of experience seem common. And, you know, Jennifer had been at the University of Oregon for many, many years at this point. I was relatively new here, but I adore it here. And I know it's not the university's policy to create this environment. It's not their stated goal. They don't have a mission statement that says we're really into civic engagement, we like to encourage green practices, and we're really hoping that sexual trauma seems super common here. That's not their policy. That's not what they set out to do. Yet somehow across students, this was the experience. This wasn't a couple women saying this. This was the most common form. So we started reflecting on how this might be happening. And luckily, perhaps, the answer appeared in our inboxes. So for those of you who are in the university system, you may be familiar with the crime alert emails that go out following the occurrence of a certain subset of crimes on or near campus. Well, oftentimes these crime alert emails went out following certain types of sexual assaults. And as a sexual trauma researcher, I read these emails and I would often get very angry because what I would see is these emails would only describe sexual assaults committed by strangers. The women were almost always victimized when they were walking home alone somewhere at night. And they were followed by these tips that were like, don't talk to strangers. And it was like, beyond the obvious of feeling, you know, slightly treated like a child as an adult woman, I also was angry that this is not what sexual assault looks like. We knew from decades of research that sexual assault is often committed in a victim's home by someone they know, and not talking to strangers is just not going to cut it. And so what I decided to do is test if maybe these emails were a piece of the puzzle. Certainly an entire culture is not created upon an email that goes out, you know, once or twice a term, but I wonder what the effects were. So what I did, in about 2012, I believe, I randomly assigned students to read one of three emails. This typical email that describes a stranger perpetrated sexual assault, an alternative email that I delighted in writing that was describing an acquaintance assault in the victim's home, and the safety tips were about getting consent before you have sex with someone. And then I asked them to rate their agreement with common myths and misconceptions about sexual assault. So this idea that most rapes are committed by strangers. A lot of times women who say they were raped actually just had an unpleasant sexual experience and now they're trying to get back at the person. These common myths and misconceptions about what rape and sexual assault look like. I also asked them to estimate some things for me. What percentage of women do you think are raped in college? What percentage of those rapes are perpetrated by someone they know versus a stranger? I asked them just to type in their guesses. And the only way these groups of students differed is which email they had been assigned to read before answering these questions. There was no reason to expect that they differed in any meaningful way beyond that. What we found was that these emails apparently only affect males. No matter what we did to the females, they answered the questions the same way. But males are changeable. What we found was that in that typical email condition, where students read an email about a stranger perpetrated sexual assault, males endorsed higher agreement with those myths about sexual assault. What we found in the condition where the men read about that alternative email about a sexual assault perpetrated by an acquaintance in a victim's home, they actually estimated the highest rate of acquaintance assault, even higher than the women. So there was something about merely reading one of these emails that shifted what some of these important outcomes look like. And if you think about the way that that might contribute to an environment around sexual assault, what seems common? What actually seems like it counts as rape? I think this might be part of the piece of the puzzle. How the university communicates about sexual assault has a real impact in what students understand. The other thing that we found was that women who had been sexually assaulted by someone they knew, when they read that typical crime alert email, they rated the University of Oregon as higher in institutional betrayal. They indicated more agreement with statements like the university covers up reports of sexual assault, the university creates an environment where these types of experiences seem common or like no big deal. And remember, they weren't reporting their own experiences of this. We only knew that they had this history based on a different questionnaire that they had filled out. They weren't saying the university did this to me, but they were saying that this was true of the university after reading this email about stranger perpetrated sexual assault that tells women not to talk to strangers if they don't want to get assaulted. Where we went after this study is a bit more familiar to you now. We started wondering about the broader environment, the bigger context, not just the emails. We started wondering about what the climate was like at the University of Oregon. And this was a direction of research that we had been thinking about for quite some time. Because while we always technically study the University of Oregon when we collect data here, we always mean to generalize our results. We always mean to understand these patterns in the broader population. But we began wondering about what makes one school better or worse at these things? Do all schools have these types of environments? Would we find this anywhere? And so what we've done over the past, actually collecting data several months, but we've been working on this for well over a year, with our colleague Marina Rosenthal, we randomly sampled quite a lot of students over this summer. So we initially started out with 5,000 emails provided by our registrar, and we invited all those students to participate in the study. It was the summer, they're college students, about 1,000 started our study. And 982 of them finished. We got quite a lot of interesting data. And I'm going to be talking about some of those data today. So the first thing I want to point out is that we asked about sexual violence in the same way we always do. Very, very behavioral measures. We asked about fondling and touching, completed and attempted, oral, vaginal, and anal sex, all without consent. This time, however, we asked them only tell us about things that happened here, only tell us about things that happened since you were a student at the University of Oregon. We also asked about a range of other questions that kind of fed into that environment, institutional betrayal, knowing friends who'd been sexually assaulted. We wanted to get a big picture of what happened, what this looks like here. What we found is upsetting. We are used to seeing these numbers as sexual assault researchers, but these are our students. We found that 10% of women in our sample said they had been raped. And to be clear, what they actually said was someone inserted their penis, fingers, or objects into my vagina or into my anus without my consent. If you add in attempted items, those same items but just that are rephrased, someone tried to do these things, that number jumps to 19% of women in our sample here at the University of Oregon. If you include oral sex and non-consensual fondling, 35% of women and 14% of men. When you consider our students who don't identify in these binary genders, non-traditional gendered students, 35% of them experience a non-consensual sexual event while students at the University of Oregon. When we asked them about institutional betrayal, 40% of students who had had a non-consensual sexual experience here also indicated institutional betrayal. And this number looks pretty similar across different sexual experiences: fondling, attempted oral sex, completed vaginal penetration. It's not the case that more severe sexual experiences are more likely to be associated with institutional betrayal. People have this experience across different types of non-consensual events. I'm going to be talking about some new data today. I'm not sure if some of you guys had seen some of the more recent coverage of this study, but I want to touch on a couple new things here today. Again, the most common type of institution reported was a university. And again, those most common types are creating this environment where this type of sexual experience seems more likely. But I want to talk about students who talked about their friends' experiences, because this starts getting at this environment and what the climate around these issues are. 9% of participants said that they knew someone who had been sexually assaulted while they were at UO. 46% of these students identified institutional betrayal related to their friends' experiences. On average, though, they identified more types of institutional betrayal for their friends, and they also indicated more severe types of experiences, so more higher rates of institutional betrayal for their friends. This goes back to something Jennifer had been talking about this unawareness. It may be easier for students to recognize betrayal when it happens to their friends than when it happens to them. Asking about and understanding their friends' experiences, I think, is important. I want to go back to this thing that I keep emphasizing and end with that. When we ask students these very clear behavioral questions, we're doing that for a reason. Because when we ask women who have reported someone putting their fingers, an object, or their penis in their vagina without their consent, when we ask them to agree with whether they agree with the statement, "I have been raped," only 30% of those women say yes. When we add in oral, non-consensual oral contact and all those attempted, when you ask them, "Have you been sexually assaulted?" only 40% say yes. And I think back on the email study, and I wonder about the effects of the public conversations we have, and this is a public conversation. How often we talk about sexual assault as something that's perpetrated by strangers in these out-of-the-way places. And those stories are true. Those do happen to women, absolutely. But this isn't the norm, and it shouldn't be the normal way that we talk about it. And I wonder if this public image advanced by the university, by the media, affects how willing these students are to label their own experiences as sexual assault, as rape. I think about how this relates to the figure that 90% of the women who indicated a non-consensual experience said they did not report it. I think about how this affects the way that we very naturally relate to this topic in a very personal way. When it touches us personally, ourselves or someone we know, someone we love, then it's real, and it's a very easy topic to hold on to and care about. But for so many people, they think that it doesn't affect them personally. And I think about the fact that 90% of the women that had these experiences told no one. And what an opportunity we're missing to support our students. And so I want to end on a recommendation that me talking about these data publicly is the first step, of course. Talking about sexual assault and rape behaviorally is important as well. It might help people identify their experiences. But I want to encourage you guys to continue talking about this. Notice the places when I was sharing this data with you that you wanted to turn away and recognize that that's common. This is a hard topic to keep in our consciousness. It's a hard topic to bring up when we think it might not affect the people around us. But I think that the data that I shared today show that it's very unlikely that this has not touched someone close to you, and that it's unlikely still that it's not something you should care about. So, thank you.
Have members form their questions and get back.
You're listening to KLCC NPR for Oregonians in Eugene, 89.7 FM KLCC, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet.
City Club program addressing sexual assault from institutional betrayal to institutional courage. Thank you for being here, and we'll go now to our member questions.
I'm Arnold Ismack, a City Club member, and I'd like to thank you on our behalf for sharing your interesting research with us. It's a taboo subject in a lot of environments, but you're pretty candid today. But I'd like you to address something about institutional behavior that you brought up in your talks here at the University of Oregon. Just this past month, the art department at the university abandoned a program in figure drawing that had gone on for many, many, many years for students and the public. And the underlying theme was that this was to prevent sexual misbehavior. But artists all over town are accusing the university of bias there. What do you think of this abandonment of that figure drawing project?
I think I'll take this question. First of all, I want to say that, of course, this is outside of our area of expertise. You know, we're psychology researchers, and I can give you my honest answer to the question, but I also want to say there's a lot I don't know about that decision. I don't know the factors that were all weighed. I can tell you that from the outside, it has an unfortunate potential side effect message, which is that the way to prevent, say, sexual assault is to ask people not to be clothed or not clothed in a certain way. And it suggests that by changing the behavior, say, of would-be victims, that's going to reduce the level of violence. Now, that message is implicit. It's not one that was made explicitly. I mean, as a patron of the arts, I feel sad. I was an art major in the beginning of college and benefited greatly from the live models of that nature. So, but as I said, I don't know all the factors that went into that decision.
My name is Susan Conley. Thank you so much for coming. Indeed, it has been going on forever. And I, 40 years ago, as a young woman, three different older white men tried to attack me. Two landlords and one employer. So it has been going on, and for way too long we haven't talked about it. So thank you so much. My question is, I recall when the incident with the football players started that you offered to do a study for the university and you were turned down. If that's correct, could you speak to that, please?
It is the case that did happen. It was in a period of great crisis for the university. I should clarify that this was a case I think you were referring to involved basketball, not football. I had a meeting with the administration a few days after the case came to public light, and I was asked for my recommendations of what the university could do. And I, since I already had written with my collaborators a campus climate survey, and it was at that point a week or two after the White House had recommended campus climate surveys as the number one first step, I said, well, I think we should conduct a campus climate survey, and I have one ready to go. My intention had been, prior to that, to put in a grant proposal to get it funded, but that takes a while, and so I did say, if you want to do it now, I'm going to need some support for participant compensation. And for reasons I cannot actually entirely explain, that the university decided not to do that.
I'm Jack Marietta. I am hoping and asking if you could provide a linkage or an application of betrayal theory to the data that Ms. Smith provided. I was missing the connection between the two and hope that the theory might illuminate the data.
So thanks for your question. I'm wondering at, I'll try this at a couple different levels, and I'm wondering if you can let me know which one hits home best. So the first linkage between the betrayal trauma theory and the data that I presented today was merely the fact that we asked about institutional behavior that we're interpreting as betrayal. So failing to protect students, failing to provide a safe educational environment when that is in fact the one of the main purposes of universities. And so at that very first level, when students report these types of experiences of institutions failing to create this type of environment and creating more distress for them around sexual violence, that first step there is one of the first connections to betrayal trauma theory. So the fact that institutions in and of themselves can in fact betray. One of the other links that I talked about today was this unawareness, so the mismatch between the rates of institutional betrayal reported by students as personal experiences versus the much higher rates they reported for their friends' experiences. And when you look at the mismatch between how common institutional betrayal is when people describe their own experiences versus when they're watching others go through similar things, one of the explanations that might make sense there is that there's this unawareness of betrayal when it happens to you, because to confront it or even acknowledge it threatens a very important relationship and identity, in this case, your identity as a student at the University of Oregon. And so that mismatch between your own awareness, or rather your awareness of your own experiences and others, might point to betrayal blindness. Much more tenuous, perhaps, is even that mismatch between students indicating these items describing behaviorally sexual assault and rape and their willingness to label it as such. And so in this case, maybe not advancing or staying aware of the fact that their experiences do fit this definition of sexual assault and rape in an environment that doesn't seem to take those things seriously might also be a protective form of unawareness. So does that answer your question? Thank you. You gave a thumbs up for the radio audience.
Hi, I'm Rita Radistitz, and I've been a City Club member since 2012. Our table's question is, what does your research suggest that the university should do differently to change the rate of sexual assault on campuses and the institutional response? And then I want to add a second part to it of what, if anything, did your research find around the role of alcohol in the study?
So the first question is a question about what could the university be doing differently, really recommendations. And I want to encourage you to pay close attention on October 22nd to the recommendations that the Senate Task Force is going to be making to the Senate at the University of Oregon. I think this is going to be a substantial list of recommendations, and I don't want to try to encapsulate them and miss anything right now. I think I would say two things, but this is not exhaustive. It's just two things we could be doing. One is to really look hard and address this matter of not reporting. That is, students not reporting. And a finding that we presented a few days ago that I think I want to come back to is that of the students who had non-consensual sexual experiences, 28% of them indicated that the university had, or the institution, in most cases that was a university, had made it difficult to report. Now, we don't know all the detail of how that, what made it difficult. And I think more research is needed to follow up on that. But that's a lot. 28% are saying something made it difficult, the institution made it difficult to report. So that's a place we just need to take a lot of energy and resources and hone right in to help individuals report. And then the other thing is, not surprisingly, I'm going to say, we really need to do a lot more campus climate surveys. We need a lot more research like this. We need to follow up on this. We need to see what happens when we roll out a new program. Can we reduce rates? Can we measure it?
So I will speak to the question around alcohol use. So one of the things we asked, and if people are familiar with kind of data analysis and data collection, this has created an enormous amount of data, but for each non-consensual sexual experience a student indicated, we asked them to describe how it had happened, who had perpetrated it, that is, someone they knew, a stranger, someone that was a student at the school versus they were unsure or not a student at the school, and the gender of the perpetrator. And when we looked at the options we had given them for how the experience was perpetrated, so what type of coercion was used, this could be physical or verbal or being too drunk or high to stop what was happening or to understand what was happening, so this kind of alcohol or substance facilitated assault, that was one of the most common ways that the assault was perpetrated. So this is the type of coercion most commonly reported and most commonly reported for acquaintances. I want to give a little bit of context to this finding, though, from a different study actually led by Marina Rosenthal, and she actually studies perpetration behavior. And it turns out when you ask people those same behavioral questions, they'll tell you that they've done them. And in this case, among self-identified perpetrators of sexual assault, Marina actually found that the rate of drinking was much lower amongst these students. What this suggests is, aren't two drunk college kids not being clear with each other about what they're interested in? This suggests a much different pattern of perpetration and the role of drugs and alcohol in it. And so that pattern's a little bit harder to tease apart in this case, but that's what I would say the role of alcohol is in these findings.
Hi, I'm Josh Burstein, City Club member for about 4 years. Our table was talking about the reporting, and you just mentioned that, Professor. We look at a question of what would the ideal person look like who survivors would report to? Are we talking about a university administrator, an academic advisor, even though this is not an academic issue, a counselor, a doctor, a police officer? Who would be the most comfortable, if you will, person to report to?
I guess not to be too flip in my response to this, but probably someone who just treats them well when they do report. We are working through right now in our Senate task force and among some other committees to really tease apart this issue of who should be receiving these reports, recognizing in the case of sexual assault that it's always up to the victim themselves who they choose to report to, or at least in an ideal world it should be. And in this case, I would just suggest someone who's trained in receiving these types of reports first off, because it's very tempting. I'm wondering, as you guys were hearing the presentation, some of the things that ran through your head of how can it be so common, what are students doing, why don't they prevent this? Someone who's able to respond in a much more helpful way and kind of keep some of those initial thoughts inside or doesn't have them. That being said, there are a range of resources on the campus, and I think just some aren't as well known about as others. So that's definitely an issue in terms of making recommendations that we'll be focusing on the task force at least.
Lisa Arkin, City Club member. The question from our table is, has your research found any information or do you have an opinion or some concepts to discuss regarding how does the big collegial sports culture and the sort of dominant male cultural icon, especially as perpetuated by sports, contribute to unwanted sexual relations or institutional betrayal?
You want us to answer?
I'll answer some.
Okay. So thanks for your question. To back up a little bit, so outside of research that we've conducted, one of the maybe more surprising findings about the relationship between athletics and sexual assault is that student athletes themselves are actually at a higher risk compared to the general population of students for experiencing sexual assault. And I know there's a common stereotype that the hypermasculization of sports somehow facilitates perpetration, and certainly we've got salient examples that often receive a lot of news coverage when they do happen in that case. But one of the ways that I think institutional betrayal might inform this type of kind of subculture and sexual assault is a recognition that organized sports for the athletes participating in them, that is a very powerful institution and one that inspires loyalty and love and trust. And so when we ask these questions that aim to reveal what's happening in our athletics, is there a heightened risk, are there more perpetrators, what's going on there, and see as a result those institutions becoming more closed and more seemingly more hostile and unwilling to look within, that's a very natural response of a threatened institution. And so to understand that and maybe consider that in how we try to ask these types of questions or make changes in these organizations, I think that's a way that institutional betrayal can really inform that.
I would just add to that, sexual violence demands a certain level of silence and secrecy. If you don't have that, it ends. It cannot exist in a society that has decided it's not acceptable if it's exposed. So it lives in secrecy. It lives in our silences. And to the extent that institutions are being not transparent, are making decisions in secrecy, are keeping information away from the community and the public, this feeds into exactly the environments in which sexual violence breeds.
Dan Solit, City Club. Question I have is on reporting. I know that there's a lot of shame involved in this, and so it does tend to make it harder to get someone to report if they're not wanting to. It's not like someone takes a rock and smashes your car and you call campus police. Mm-hmm. The campus police come and say, oh, it's just a student, don't worry about it. We'll take it to the police, maybe we'll get this resolved. But in terms of a sexual assault, how does that work? When a person feels violated, what would be the next steps on campus or off campus, and what are the paths available to them? And do you have any empirical or anecdotal data on how that happens? Thank you.
Part of the answer is that there is no one path. And in fact, right now, students can tell any employee at the University of Oregon, and almost all employees are mandated reporters under current university rules. That means they should be reporting it up the ladder so that it gets accounted for and aggregated. There are a few exceptions of confidential people who can keep some information in confidence. But I think what students often face is they don't know that they could tell anyone. They don't know to whom they should report. And I think part of the answer to your question is that this is an area where we need to become much more clear so that there's not the confusion. You think we have some data too?
We've collected some data on what aspects of a sexual experience or non-consensual sexual experience kind of seems to lead to different reporting choices. But one of the things I want to make clear is we do have some centralized reporting offices that are really important. And so, again, as our radio audience can't see who's in the audience, but in fact, a couple of them are here today, and that's a really important resource that I think the fact that even housed within the Dean of Students office, for example, we have people whose only job is to take confidential reports and make sure students get matched up with services that they need. I would fathom a guess that if you asked the average University of Oregon undergraduate, they would have no clue where the Dean of Students office was located. They would have never heard the name Renee DeSautel. And this idea of getting the information out there is one of the institutional practices that I think we often fall down a little bit on because, again, well, maybe it's not that common. Maybe this many students don't need these services. But the fact of the matter is many do, and I would guess many just don't know where to go.
My name is Ruth Dimler, City Club member. And I'm just wondering if we're starting a little late. Have we been communicating at the high school age? Mm. Every time I open a book or see a movie, or there are always these warnings about sexual assault. And I was wondering, what are the high schools doing about this? I know they have sexual education, sex education. And I was wondering how far this goes. And I have two grandsons that are in high school, and I just want to know what's happening.
That's a great question. And even if we do fix the problem in high school, we're still starting too late, because the problem of sexual violence in our society starts in the home. Really, that's fundamentally where we have the breeding ground. It's very hard to fix the American family. We don't really know how to do that. We have so many, and we lack the resources. Universities and colleges are at some level too late, but then again, this is a cycle. And so any intervention point is going to be beneficial. And universities and colleges have resources in a way that most high schools don't, most parts of our society don't. We're also a containable or countable number of entities. So although I don't think sexual violence starts in colleges, it's a place where it should be not amplified as it currently is. It's a place where it should be addressed and greatly reduced. We do believe that one of the lines of research we've had for a while in my laboratory has been on the issue of disclosure and how to teach people to take a disclosure. Carly mentioned that it is so important that the person who hears the disclosure handle it well. It's very easy to cause additional harm by invalidating a person, changing the subject, not believing them. So we have been studying this in the laboratory, and we know that people can be taught to take disclosures in a better way. And this should be occurring at maybe middle school. This should be part of American education. It's not just sexual assault. It's disclosures of disturbing, distressing, hurtful events. We can make the world a better place just by how we respond to one another when we hear those disclosures. And this is so amenable to education. I keep laughing when my kids come home year after year after year learning about how to prevent HIV or what they should be eating, and not learning basic communication of that nature.
I find it interesting, having been in several state universities and one private one, that this behavior that you've described that came out in your research, when it happens on campus, it's sort of plagiarism plus. It's dealt with by a system that is intended to deal with student misbehavior. Nobody says crime. If the same behavior happens to people of that age or any age outside the university or the institution, it's a crime. It's rape. You go to court. You have lawyers. There's a problem with the fact that the university deals with it in many, many in-house ways that just they don't say crime. Do you have any response to that?
Well, I mean, this is something we talk about and think about a lot, and it's a complicated issue because sexual violence is many things. It is a crime, but it's also a human rights violation. Because it's gendered, it's a civil rights violation. It's a public health problem. It is many things. Our criminal justice system has not historically done a good job with this crime. When students are on college campuses, they have the rights of citizens, but they also have the rights of an equal opportunity for education and to be safe at their colleges. So colleges do have responsibility towards the students above and beyond or separate from the criminal justice system. One of the complications is some victims of sexual violence do not want to go to the criminal justice system, perhaps because they don't want to get hurt by that system. So this is a really difficult issue, and I think colleges across the country are grappling with it. Are we out of time, or?
Ask a follow-up question.
Are you a member?
Actually, I'm a guest.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Thanks. Thank you. Thank you all for bringing clarity and vision to this difficult question, addressing sexual assault from institutional betrayal to institutional courage. And thanks again to our sponsors today, Evans Elder Brown, Gatos, Churnside and Balthrop, and Dot Dotson. We meet again next week on Friday, October the 10th, at the Downtown Athletic Club for Oregon's Geology. Scientists warn of hazards, but do lawmakers and agencies respond? Our guest speakers will be State Geologist Vicki McConnell and Oregon Senator Arne Robian. Thank you again for joining us today.